The War on Science, who's waging it, why it matters, and what we can do about it. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, September 21st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome science writer Sean Otto to the program. The Augustana Library Associates is hosting his visit to South Dakota in October. We'll get to know the author, his work, and the impact of his book in a COVID society. Our literary spotlight continues with a conversation between SDPB's Lee Strubinger and John Lauck as we explore the intersection between state politics and literature. Plus, images of the past and a visit with poet Chris Vondracek, that's later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
Good afternoon with SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. Governor Kristi Noem is ordering the Department of Education to delay revisions to the state's social studies standards. The move comes after a working group submitted draft revisions. The department reduced the number of references in the draft to Native American history and culture. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
Members of the working group have mixed reactions to the governor's announcement. Paul Harnes is a retired social studies teacher from Yankton.
Well, my instant reaction is she admitted there is a mistake, then she should allow the same people who did them the first time to come back and make some changes and not just hire a whole new crew.
Harnes says the working group put hours into revising the standards. Sherry Johnson is the education director for the Lake Traverse Reservation. She says the revision process should continue as usual.
The delay of it, meaning she's not addressing it. And she's not addressing the concerns that are already there that are very prevalent on the comment. And so I'm thinking the people are speaking and she's not wanting to hear what they're saying.
Noem's announcement comes after hundreds of public comments and an Indigenous-led protest at the Capitol. The governor says South Dakotans should learn about Native American history and culture. But Noem has not specifically commented on whether she agrees with the department reducing references to this content. Noem's spokesman says the Department of Education increased balance to the working group's proposals, but more changes are needed. The department has not explained why it reduced Native American references, but says the latest draft is an increase from the current standards. I'm SDPB's Ariel Zients.
The South Dakota Board of Regents is hosting public meetings to report findings from a task force. State lawmakers created the task force last year to study the operations, costs, and efficiency of South Dakota's public universities. The task force is made up of regents, lawmakers, university presidents, and community leaders. Brian Mayer is the executive director of the Board of Regents. He says one of the task force's jobs is an economic impact study.
Would you invest $5 if that $5 investment would give you $100 back in a reasonable amount of time? I think most people would say yes to that. I think we're going to see that the economic impact of higher education in South Dakota is well worth the money that we're putting into it.
The public meetings begin Thursday in Brookings. They continue through October 14th in cities around the state. The Ogallala Lakota Tribal Council voted to close schools on the reservation, citing a high level of COVID-19 cases. Students from Red Cloud Indian School protested the council's decision. Students say they disagree with shutting down because more are vaccinated and follow the rules associated with the pandemic. Adriano Rama is a junior at Red Cloud. He says the closing of the schools will impact the future of the Native American youth.
It's obviously something that affects us. It affects our education and it affects our health, affects our mental health, and it affects just all in all our future, like our future of our lives. When you're in high school, there's nothing really else you have except high school. Like, that is your life.
Students initially planned to protest outside of the tribe's offices. They were invited to meet with OST Tribal President Kevin Killer to voice their opinions. The council voted for students to return back to school this week. For listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Members of U.S. Congress returned to Washington to face looming deadlines to avoid a government shutdown, a debt default, and to face the challenges of a massive infrastructure bill. U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson spent the 30-day recess listening to South Dakotans talk about pertinent issues of the day. He's joining us now with an update. Congressman Johnson, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Anytime, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about what's on South Dakotans' minds when you were here during the recess listening.
Well, sometimes there's a disconnect between what the news stations are talking about and what South Dakotans are talking about. But honestly, during August, there was pretty close alignment. People are upset. They're emotional about Afghanistan. They are emotional. They're upset about the southern border, both the humanitarian crisis and the national security implications. And there's a lot of concern about spending. And I think there's also a real sense, probably the fourth one I would add, Lori, is there are, you know, probably half of South Dakota is really concerned about COVID and, concerns that the federal government could do more to help on that front. The other half thinks that the federal government's already done too much. That would be the one area where there was very little agreement.
Tell us where you begin when you head back to Washington. I want to start with this idea of government funding, the September 30th deadline, the potential for debt default, and just the nuances of what you have to negotiate and navigate with other representatives.
We have pulled together. It's just a tangled mess. And I do think John Boehner, a former Republican Speaker of the House, in his book called Nancy Pelosi the most powerful speaker perhaps in American history. And she certainly is. She's very good at her job. I'll tell you, Lori, I think she's miscalculated. There are four major things coming together all in the next 2 weeks. And she has allowed, in some cases, forced them to become tangled together. And I'm honestly nervous about the ability of Congress to unravel even one of them, much less four. You know, we have a debt ceiling. There's a chance we could default on our debts, which America has never done. Our government could shut down on September 30th. We haven't appropriated funding over the course of the next year. That's the second issue. We have Joe Biden's agenda, both the bipartisan infrastructure package as well as, I think, the far more objectionable $3.5 trillion spending package. All of these are inextricably woven together, and it's creating, I think, an environment where I have very little predictability over what's going to happen.
Is there room for bipartisan compromise, or is this a hunker down and see who can get their agenda passed moment? What are you seeing?
Well, on, you know, the debt ceiling and infrastructure have historically been bipartisan items. It's been messy, but we've always gotten there in a bipartisan way. You know, I do think you've got, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal have all talked about the $3.5 trillion package as really reinventing government's role and reweaving the social safety net from a cradle-to-grave perspective. I mean, all of them are really talking, all three of those newspapers have talked about this in hyperbolic ways. That's how big it is. And I fear, Lori, that the size and the partisan nature of the $3.5 trillion is casting a pretty big shadow. I mean, bipartisanship has to be cultivated. It just doesn't show up. It is built on trust. And I think there are a lot of Republicans, from centrist Republicans to far-right Republicans, who right now feel as though there has not been anybody on the Democratic leadership side who's done anything to cultivate a sense of bipartisanship on the House. The Senate's been better from that perspective.
Women's Health Protection Act, Defense Authorization Bill, in spite of all this sort of commingling of debt and funding and infrastructure, you also have huge issues to discuss regarding the future of Roe v. Wade, for example. Tell us a little bit about what you're following there.
Yeah, you're right. In both, the Roe v. Wade stuff, as well as you mentioned the NDAA. Most people probably don't well understand the National Defense Authorizing Act, but for 60 years in a row, no matter how partisan or ugly D.C. has been, that we've always been able to come together 60 years in a row to pass the NDAA, which really lays out our strategic vision and the tools that we want our military to use to accomplish that vision over the course of the next year. And last year, it for the first time became really, really partisan. This year, the good news is I think we have a little bit of return to form. This passed out of committee with only two no votes, so that would have been 50 or 60 yes votes. And I'm hopeful that we can get a strong bipartisan vote on the floor, too. You know, the military policy, along with things like infrastructure and farm policy, I mean, those have really been the holy trinity of always bipartisan. I hope we don't lose those.
Congressman Johnson, not only are South Dakotans watching and you hear their frustration when you talk to them face to face, but the world is watching. And what is your message to South Dakotans about Congress's decision and ability to get things done when the rest of the world is looking at us and wondering, is America okay?
Yeah, I do think that there have been three or four things in recent months that have given the world some pause. Tony Blair, who is a relatively mild-mannered left-of-center former prime minister of the United Kingdom, I mean, he called the way we withdrew from Afghanistan imbecilic. And earlier this week, I guess it would have been yesterday, France recalled its ambassador to the United States for the first time in world history. And so we are there are lots of things that are causing the world to kind of wonder what is going on in America. And I'm going to be honest, Lori, Congress is not well positioned right now to seem like we're the adults in the room. And I'm just going to give you one example. And I think, you know, I'm not wired to be terribly partisan, but I was in an ag committee hearing this morning, and we have wildfires that are raging the West. We have half of our country in drought. We have a $50 billion threat of African swine fever that for the first time in history is in the Western Hemisphere, knocking on our door. And we have mandatory price reporting that expires in 9 days. Those are the mechanisms that we use to try to address deficiencies in the cattle market. Four huge deals to South Dakota and the West. Today, instead of dealing with those in the Agricultural Committee, we marked up a resolution for Blueberry Month, naming last month Blueberry Month. And I wish this was a joke. It's not. And so I lost it a little bit in committee this morning, just talking about how we do need to be the adults in the room, and we do need to find bipartisan solutions. I mean, listen, African swine fever has an almost 100% mortality rate for pigs. This is not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. This is let's be a fully functioning government and address epidemiological threats in a scientific and common sense way, and we are having a hard time finding a way forward.
U.S. Representative, Congressman, sorry, I'm stuck on Blueberry Month in my mind there, Congressman Johnson. So thank you for joining us today and laying out some of those things. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Hey, Lori, one more thing, 10 seconds, because I don't want to leave people feeling too bad.
Thank you.
America's still a great country, and we still have a lot of great people in Congress. We're in a bad spot right now, but I'm just going to leave your listeners with this. Don't lose hope, because we've got to keep the faith, and we got to keep in there working, because this stuff matters.
Dusty Johnson, thanks so much. Ahead on the program, the SDPB Spotlight shines on our literary heritage. Lee Strubinger is going to talk with John Lauck about literature and politics. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
Earl Garner was an effervescent and boundlessly inventive jazz pianist who was also a household name and major concert attraction in his prime. His legacy has been reinvigorated lately with a steady stream of new releases, including remastered classic albums and previously unreleased performances. The latest is a 1959 Garner concert from Symphony Hall. We'll hear a few tracks this evening on Jazz Nightly. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. Arts South Dakota is offering opportunities for arts and humanities organizations to grow with federal funds from the American Rescue Plan. You can learn more at artssouthdakota.org/grants.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport. In the Moment with Lori Walsh keeps you in touch with South Dakota news, culture, leaders, and perspectives. Expect in-depth civil conversations about the day's news on listener-supported SDPB.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month, SDPB shines the spotlight on South Dakota's literary heritage. Today, we look at the intersection between literature and politics. When John Lauck was teaching at SDSU, he was asked to lead a class on the history of South Dakota. As he started working the outline for that course, one of the aspects he found most intriguing was the people. Those moving to the state in the early years were from the Midwest, places like Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Also, there were immigrants from Norway and Germany. Lauck tells SDPB's Lee Strubinger that he wanted to find out what that meant.
I wanted to be able to say something about what that meant, that the founding people of South Dakota were Midwesterners. And so I looked into what was the political culture of the Midwest, how should it be described, what sort of culture did they bring, and I discovered there really wasn't anything written about it. And so I kind of went down that rabbit hole of exploring what exactly is the Midwest so I could explain early South Dakota. And that's turned into this whole big project of, you know, what is the Midwest? What are its parameters? What are the main themes of its history?
Is describing the Midwest easier or harder than describing, say, the South or the East Coast or the West Coast?
I think coming to terms with what the Midwest is much more difficult than describing other regions, and in particular the South, because the South you can clearly delineate as the former states of the Confederacy. That's easy. And it was the place of the peculiar institution of slavery. There wasn't slavery in Minnesota and the Dakotas, organized slavery like there was in Georgia and Alabama. So that makes the South a much more organized, coherent unit to analyze. And of course, New England is its own particular unit. And I think there's a real shared commonality to the desert Southwest, Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Phoenix and all that. The Midwest is a little larger. It's more diverse. It's more polyglot. But still, it does have a regional identity. Just because its regional identity is a little bit weaker than the South doesn't mean it does not exist. I edited a book for the Center for Western Studies in Sioux Falls a few years ago about where does the Midwest end and the Great Plains begin. And this is one of these great exercises in setting boundaries and in describing what's in and what's not. And in terms of South Dakota, where you have your listeners, the divide goes right down the middle. You could say for just to make it simple, the 100th meridian, which roughly divides the state at the Missouri River. But if you want to be even more precise, probably the 98th meridian, somewhere between Mitchell and the Missouri River, you can really see the changes in the land and the farming practices, et cetera, that make the West River part of South Dakota different from the East River part, which is heavily Midwestern. It's kind of an adjunct of Iowa and Minnesota.
My guest is John Lauck, who is editor of the Plains Political Tradition. John, I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about some essays that were done in the Plains Political Tradition, any volume, if you will, that help you kind of understand South Dakota politics today.
Sure. I should say, first of all, that this whole series began when I was sitting in my office at South Dakota State University and the New York Times called about a political story related to South Dakota. And the reporter said, I want to be able to describe the political culture of South Dakota in a sentence. And how should I do that? Should I call it a deep red state? Should I call it a reddish state that's kind of purple sometimes? Should I call it a populist state? What should I do? So I got to thinking about this and brought in some of the smartest people I know, like John Miller, the dearly departed John Miller, the historian of South Dakota. And we started thinking about, well, what's a good way to describe this place? And that became an essay that was published in South Dakota History, the quarterly journal of Publish and Peer. And then we thought there's so much more to say, we should do a book on this. And then it became two books and three books, and now we're working on volume four on this. And some of the essays that really speak to me are relate to the agrarian orientation of the state. They relate to some of our prominent political leaders like Bill Janklow. There's a great chapter in the first volume of the series about Bill Janklow and the American Indian movement. I mean, this was a very important story in terms of his rise in South Dakota politics that I think a lot of people have forgotten now because it's a long time ago at this point. There are some essays about leaders like Coe Crawford, an early progressive Republican in South Dakota that are extremely interesting. Of course, Peter Norbeck had a major influence on our state, a governor and later senator who did a great deal to shape the Black Hills and create Custer Park and Sylvan Lodge and all those institutions, West River. So the essays in these four volumes really cover the waterfront.
So I think you just broke some news there. New volume coming out, sounds like next year. Can you give us a little teaser of what to expect in this upcoming volume?
There will be, if everything goes according to plan, knock on wood, a fourth volume released next fall, hopefully in time for the midterm elections of 2022, when everyone will be thinking about politics. Some of the essays in this volume will be focused on the political career of George Mikkelson. And there will be an analysis of all the political ads that he ran during his runs for governor in 1986 and 1990, including a famous ad in which he is in a barn in rural South Dakota and pulls a baby calf out of a cow, which was an ad that made a big splash back then. So I think people will be interested in reading that. We have a chapter on Governor and then Senator William Buelow, who was the very first Democratic governor elected in South Dakota. And he ran as a very conservative Democrat, and he benefited from a deeply split Republican Party in 1926. And I think that there's a lot of lessons in that. That for Democrats to elect a governor in the state, the conditions have to be right. Republicans have to be divided. They have to have a conservative candidate. And I think the Buelow model, I think, still applies to the workings of our politics.
My guest has been John Lauk, who is the editor of one of the editors of Plain Political Tradition. John, thank you so much for your time and joining me on In the Moment.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Lee.
You can find all our literary spotlight coverage on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Up next on the program, The War on Science. We talk with science writer Sean Otto. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
For forget your financial advisor. Some people are mimicking the investment decisions of prominent politicians.
Obviously, our lawmakers have access to a lot of information that isn't readily available to all of us, and I think it's only natural to assume that some of them may be using that to drive their own investment decisions.
I'm Leila Fadel. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the 2021 virtual South Dakota Festival of Books, with Newbery Honor winner Kwame Alexander, New York Times bestseller J.A. Jantz, and others. More at sdbookfestival.com.
That disappointing jobs report for August caught a lot of people by surprise, but not everyone.
We happen to have deep insight into one of the most impacted industries right now. So we saw that in our set of employment that that number went down.
I'm Amy Scott. Data and tracking employment next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. Now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The COVID pandemic has now claimed more American lives than the flu of 1918. South Dakota, by the way, hit that milestone back in February. The U.S. population has blossomed since then, of course, but science has advanced exponentially since 1918. We've already developed and distributed several vaccines, and yet Sean Otto is an award-winning science advocate, writer, teacher, and speaker. His book, The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, What We Can Do About It, was written before COVID. Otto speaks to audiences worldwide about the scientific foundations of democracy and the causes and dangers of anti-science authoritarianism. He's co-founder and producer of the U.S. Presidential Science Debates at sciencedebate.org. Augustana Library Associates hosts Otto for their fall author event. That's October 12th at 7:30 p.m. You can be there in person or virtually. And for a preview, we welcome Sean Otto to In the Moment. Sean, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this foundation of objective truth and how people say, you know, you can make those numbers say whatever you want. All truth is relative at this point. You even hear that from journalists often. How is that at the center of what you found as you were researching and writing this book?
Yeah, what I kind of discovered is that post-World War II, there was a rise in a philosophy called postmodernism that was kind of more on the political left that really sought to disempower the ideas of objective truth and to say, no, all these other perspectives that you Nazis tried to disempower have value and have meaning. And this idea really married well with advances in civil rights and, that were going on in the United States and with the whole kind of post-war economy and social consciousness. And it became a core part of academia, moving out of philosophy and architecture and into especially education and journalism schools. And it wound up being kind of treated with a little less nuance than it was probably intended at first, and shorthanded into the idea that truth is really a matter of your perspective, and that there is no such thing as objectivity. I mean, this is the thing that you hear journalists say a lot on the speaking circuit. There's no such thing as objectivity. There's reporting, and you have different perspectives. And that's true in some cases, but in other cases, that's just plain false. If you and I both have a ruler and we go out after rainfall and we stick that in a bucket, we're going to come up with the same objective truth about how much rain fell.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back a little bit because you talk about World War II and you have a really interesting chapter in this book about the atomic bomb and children of the time and a film, Duck and Cover. And I just want to kind of go over and lay out historically for people what's happening at this time with this great exodus of scientists from Europe coming to America. And science is sort of, you know, revered. And then we use this atomic weapon twice, and there is seeds of doubt. This is going to come back to America. This is, we didn't have the ethics to keep up with the science. Sort of lay the groundwork for us about what's happening, and then tell us about this film and the interesting sort of way it intersects with how some of these kids grew up and are, you know, now running parts of our country and industry.
Yeah, for sure. It had a huge impact. I've talked to so many people who really recall Duck and Cover and the training to be prepared for nuclear war as among the most traumatic memories of their childhood. And the idea that science had advanced to the point that it could destroy you at any minute and you'd have no warning and no control on the all you could do is hide under your desk and hope for the best, and that it could strip off your skin and that you'd be living in this world if you made it into a shelter of nuclear winter. I mean, this is everybody's worst nightmare, and it was politicians' worst nightmare at the time, and they responded to it by preparing kids through essentially the equivalent of the Department of Homeland Security at the time, with this film called Duck and Cover to survive a first strike nuclear attack. The idea really developed, especially after the Soviets launched Sputnik, and politicians in the United States became concerned that if they can orbit a satellite over the United States in space, they could just as well drop atomic bombs on us. And so this bred this whole generation of people, the baby boomers, who really developed a sense of skepticism towards the moral authority of government and really an anti-government outlook that was there in, we saw it develop in the 1960s, exacerbated by the Vietnam War, but then it really worked its way into our politics and it's still alive today.
There were no adults in that film, were there? There was a sense that as a child, you were going to be by yourself. Kids weren't running in the film to be comforted by their parents who whisked them off to a safe space. It was sort of like, what kind of decision was that from a child development standpoint?
You're right.
From a perspective of art and film and what film can do to really change history, I find that chapter just really fascinating.
It was incredibly powerful, the effect that it has had, and I don't think that we really even fully come to grips with it yet. And the messaging, you know, Marshall McLuhan and the ideas of what happens in the communication, in the medium, in the way that a message is delivered, really hadn't been developed at the time. And so some of this was just naivete on our part, but the effect has had lasting consequences.
Yeah. And you do an excellent job of laying out in this book things that tend to come from the progressive or the far left and things that tend to come from what we would consider the far right or the alt-right or all these different kind of terminology and how journalism and media can kind of explode this in all kinds of different directions. It is universal politically, this journey to science doubting and anti-science work. Sort through the politics for us a little bit, because people like to put that in a box that it doesn't really fit into.
Yeah, they do. And people on the left generally tend to be just as blind as those on the right about the areas where they may be anti-science themselves. One example is the idea that GMO food is unsafe to eat. It may be other things that have political consequences or aspects to the discussion, but there's a greater percentage of scientists that say that genetically modified food is safe to eat than that say that humans are causing climate change. But that's not something that you very often hear on the left. And generally, the anti-science on the left tends to be more about unfounded concerns about hidden dangers to our health or the environment, things that the government or corporations might know about but might be covering up somehow. So the anti-vaccine movement, until recently, was largely a phenomena of the political left. It only translated into the right after people like Michelle Bachmann became concerned about the idea that the HPV vaccine, by removing a prominent cause of cervical cancer, might promote preteen or young teen sex. And it began moving in that direction. And then, of course, we all know what happened under President Trump. On the right, on the political right, the anti-science tends to be more about known dangers, but minimizing them or denying them because of the economic consequences or the political consequences of regulating them. So there it's big corporations or big government want to socialize the world and take away your freedom. So it's kind of the opposite message. And we saw our politics start to skew around these two issues of science denial, around mostly around our growing control of reproduction and around environmental issues, starting in about the early 1970s. And it's been that same split around science ever since.
We only have a couple minutes left, and you are coming to South Dakota as part of the Augustana Library Associates Fall Author on October 12th. If people can join that virtually as well, we'll give them some information here in a moment. But I want to close with the section that you have, which has battle plans, and they're all kind of broken down to different. So I'm, of course, fascinated with, in journalism, some of the things that you say journalists should really consider as they do science reporting. What do you want to leave us with as far as what can the average listener do about this?
The average listener, the most important thing that they can do, I think, is, first of all, recognize that we all are clouded by confirmation bias. It's really easy to disregard the things that we don't want to think about and to overemphasize the solutions to challenges that we do. But you got to be open-minded and ultimately decide, no matter how scary it is, if you're facing an unknown, you got to go with the evidence, the preponderance of the evidence. We'll never know everything, but go with the evidence.
Here's a few things that you need to know. The Augustana Library Associates hosts science writer Sean Otto October 12th for their fall author event. We'll put a link up on our website where registration for the free event in person and virtually is available. You can also go directly there at augielink.com/Sean Otto. Sean is S-H-A-W-N-O-T-T-O. That's also where you register. We'll put everything up on our show notes today at sdpb.org/news. And, Sean, we have a little free library now in front of our SDPB Sioux Falls studios at the corner of 4th and Phillips. And I have a copy of your book. And after the show, I'm going to put it out in that little free library and invite people to come down and pick it up so that they can read the book for themselves before you come. So, Sean, thanks so much for being here.
That's awesome. Thanks for doing that, and thanks for having me, Lori. Thanks for everything you do. Great show.
Let's take a moment now for South Dakota history. The 175th Fighter Squadron of the South Dakota Air National Guard received federal recognition this week, 75 years ago. Joe Foss was appointed to form the Air National Guard Squadron 2 months earlier, and the original mission of the squadron was defense against airborne weapons. The wing was first formed as the 387th Fighter Squadron in April 1943. It was activated a month later and flew bomber support in the skies over Europe during World War II. With the end of the war, the 387th took part in the disarmament program, then returned to the United States in September 1945. The wartime 387th Fighter Squadron was redesignated as the 175th Fighter Squadron and was allotted to the South Dakota Air National Guard in May of 1946. It was organized at the Sioux Falls Municipal Airport and was granted federal recognition on September 20, 1946 by the National Guard Bureau. The squadron was activated for duty during the Korean War and has deployed many times since to the Middle East and across the globe. The squadron was equipped with the P-47 Thunderbolt during the Second World War and now flies the F-16 Fighting Falcon. Today, the 175th is a unit of the 114th Fighter Wing, also stationed at Joe Foss Field Air National Guard Station in Sioux Falls, but the 175th was officially extended federal recognition this week in 1946. Production assistance for This Week in South Dakota History goes to Brad Tennant, Professor of History at Presentation College. Ahead on the program, we preview the South Dakota Festival of Books with poet Chris Vondracek, and Images of the Past explores how art and history can help keep us just a little bit younger. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. Should doctors who spread COVID disinformation have their licenses revoked or suspended? The Federation of State Medical Boards now says yes.
We have 660,000 Americans who died, and it's especially important and critical now that people get accurate information, especially from doctors who they trust.
Next time, here now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding by Medco, investing in your hometown to bring an expanded fiber network and next-gen tech to your door. Fiber is the future, and at Medco, the future is already underway. Medco.com/fiberforward.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. An assisted living facility can be a good option for an older person if and when living at home becomes unmanageable. There are 163 licensed assisted living centers throughout South Dakota. One thing they all have in common is shared spaces, the dining rooms, and other gathering places where residents can meet and socialize. Edgewood Healthcare runs 14 assisted living centers across the state, and they've come up with an idea to spruce up the decor in these common spaces in a way that gets residents engaged and talking. Kim Brackey is a regional sales and marketing director for Edgewood Healthcare, joining me today for Images of the Past to talk about how they're using old photographs to spark memories and conversations. Kim, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
You are taking literal images of the past to the walls of your facilities. Where did this idea come from, and where are some of the photographs coming from?
Well, the idea, I think, came a little bit from our memory cares that we have around the building or around the communities. We have historical pictures in there, but they're actually old family photos from our former president's family. So he, Russ Kubik is his name, and his family photos hang in our memory cares. And a lot of our residents really, really love looking at the old photos, looking at the farm equipment, remembering the dime store, all of those, the five and dime store, all of that. But we found that our assisted living residents enjoy it just as much. So we've gone and done historical photos of the community, and then they can remember what the town used to look like.
How many facilities has this begun in? Because it's rolling out. It's in progress. Tell me about that.
It's in progress. So we have it actually done in two buildings. One of our Sioux Falls communities, we have three in Sioux Falls, and our Brookings community also. Those are pretty complete. I still don't think they'll ever be fully done because I think they'll always be evolving a little bit and we'll be adding to them. But we also are working on Flandreau, Rapid City, and then I even started some work in a North Dakota community, and we're in seven different states, so who knows where it'll go.
Tell me a little bit about selecting the photos, you know, site-specific, but also that universal and timeless, you know, what is timeless in those photos that all residents seem to respond to, or many do?
Sure. So we've worked with the South Dakota Historical Society on these photos, but the communities themselves have a lot of say in the images we're selecting. So in Sioux Falls, in the building that we did in Sioux Falls, we didn't just select only Sioux Falls photos. We surrounded with Salem and Madison, Del Rapids. I think we have Brandon, Howard. So we do other outlying communities because it's really important that people who aren't just in Sioux Falls can resonate and reflect on some of the pictures as well. And since our different residents come from all over the state, they're not just from the city itself. So we try to reflect and gather images from all over. And that's been really fun. And we also get some feedback from the director in the community to hear about where they have a lot of residents that are from and areas that they'd like us to focus on. And we try to represent all of that.
Let's talk about how you mentioned memory care. And I'm wondering if those photos actually have a healthcare component. And what different ways, you know, is it through memory? Is it through the fact that people are getting up out of their chairs and sort of walking and engaging social? Tell me a little bit about the impact of the project potentially.
Sure. No, Laura, you're exactly right that it is something that's beneficial on multiple different levels. So the getting up and walking around in a memory care setting where people's dementia has progressed to a point that their short-term memory has really they're struggling a little bit with short-term memory, but that long-term memory is still really, really great. And so they will get up and walk around, and the pictures encourage them to explore the community, walk around, talk about the pictures, remember when. And it is something that they do not have to, they may remember the picture for a moment, but then the next day they can explore and enjoy the photo again. And we'll hear a lot of the same stories, but that's okay. We like to hear those stories. So moving is huge, especially during COVID. Yeah. When we were all kind of isolating in place a little bit, we wanted our residents to be moving as much as possible. But reminiscing therapy is another really big component of it. And that's just a fancy way of saying remembering the past. We all do it. We love to talk with friends and family about, remember that vacation we took 20 years ago? Or that type of therapy is helpful to everybody. It's enjoyable. And so it's really, really great to be able to do that in the assisted living side of it as well, because they love to talk about the things, remember when.
Yeah.
And so we'll hear residents comment about, oh, I used to have a car that looked like that. This is a black and white photo, but that car is blue and white. And then they'll tell you all about the drive-in movie they went to and things like that. So it's really fun to hear the stories that come from just looking at an old photo.
So I'm wondering then if you have recommendations or tips for caregivers, children, grandchildren who are trying to come up with conversation starters, or they're finding old photos or old scrapbooks and saying, this could be the thing that I bring to visit and talk with my loved one. How can this kind of go into the individual family level and be an effective tool of connecting and healing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think two different things with that. First of all, if you have a loved one that is starting to suffer from some dementia, or even if they're not, and they're just somebody that's telling a story, if they repeat or share a story and you're like, oh, mom or grandma, I've heard this 100 times, remember that story, because that story is really important to your loved one. Yeah. So remember that story. Have them write down some of the details. If they look at a photo and name all of their siblings in a photo, write that all down. If dementia is ever at play in the future, they might lose their verbal skills. They might not, but they might struggle with being able to place the name of all their siblings at some point in time. So if you can get that all written down now, that's a great way to capture those memories now, so that later on, if you have a loved one suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia, you can talk to them back about the picture, and they might not have the words anymore, but you can say, oh, look how pretty Gertrude looks in her dress here, and Harold sure was tall. And that those are things that maybe they've remembered and told you before, but now you can help say those words back to them and give them some comfort.
I love that. Well, if you'd like
to,
isn't that just nice? It makes my grandfather's story about how he learned to appreciate cooked carrots way more meaningful when I think about the little boy playing in the snow and then coming in from the cold and eating cooked carrots for the first time. Boy, that story when I was growing up, I got tired of hearing. And now as an adult, I'm like, oh, it was the story of a boy playing outside in Mitchell in a snowstorm and coming home to his mother who made him cooked carrots, and he loved them for the first time. Oh, that
we
makes me happy.
We have all had stories where we're where we're saying people, they tell us that one
over and over again.
But remember that one. It's important. It's an important story. So I love that you have a story like that.
All right. If you want to see samples of some of the historical photos on display at an Edgewood Assisted Living facility in Sioux Falls, you can also watch a short video about the photo project. Head over to our website, sdpb.org/images-of-the-past. Kim Brackey, welcome. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Lori. Appreciate you having me.
SDPB's September Spotlight illuminates the state's literary legacy as we take a virtual road trip to the virtual South Dakota Books, South Dakota Festival of Books, I should say. And today we're going to talk literature and journalism. Chris Vondracek is a journalist, piano player, poet, whose 2020 book Rattlesnake Summer features a poem for every county in South Dakota. He contributes music and free verse to the traveling radio program The Rock Garden Tour, and his band The Golden Bubbles will release their third album later this year. Vondracek holds degrees in literature and journalism from the University of South Dakota and in creative writing from Hamline in St. Paul. You can see his presentation on reporting and poetry on Sunday, October 3rd at noon Central, 11 Mountain, but he returns to In the Moment now for a little preview. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
Here we are just talking about the simplest of stories. And, you know, that's a poem. Sometimes some of these simple stories. Tell me a little bit about the intersection for you between journalism and poetry. How does that all work in your life?
No, totally. In fact, actually, the story that when I was on hold listening to the last interview, I was sparked by one of the last conversations I had with my grandmother in Beersford, South Dakota, was about essentially kind of the legacy of sort of like the Klan in Union County. And she was concerned about, she thought that essentially some local farmers were joining the Klan, and Grandma kept saying to me, and this was like, you know, weeks before she passed away. Mm. And she said, I had never heard this story. And she said, you know, I don't know if they knew what they actually joined. And so she was trying to like project some sympathy onto these gentlemen.
Yeah.
And she said, but the times were so tough that she had actually, these gentlemen who were very anti-Catholic would wear the robes, the white sheets or whatever, you know, and then that during the day they would go and ask for potatoes from the store of food that the local Catholic priest in Union County kept for farmers who were on tough times.
Wow.
And to me, that's like, that's a poem, right? And it's probably made it into a poem. And it got published in Cutbank Literary Review out of Montana back in 2015 and 2016. Uh-huh. But to me, that was like exactly the sort of like juncture that we talk about, or I like to talk about when I think about where poetry and journalism meet up. That was not my story, right? That was my grandmother's story.
Yeah.
And it came to me through interview, which is, of course, that's what we're doing right here, right? It's a journalistic tool. But I felt like there was a way to do that, not in a journalistic way, but in more of a poetic way, using poetic language, you know, metaphor, assonance, sort of rhyme if needed, maybe verse if you feel so inclined, if you're, you know, more formal, to give you kind of wide margins on the page, but to tell that story that is gleaned through journalistic technique, to tell it in a poetic way. And so that is sort of what my, now I may have to rewrite my presentation after hearing that last radio spot, because I'm like, maybe that should be my lead. I don't know.
I'm rethinking like my life right now because of that, because it's just so, what a fascinating little thing, how everything kind of collides there, because it never occurred to me to use journalistic, you know, hey, an interview. So a conversation with my mother could turn into a poem. Well, that's journalism. And then what are these tools that I can apply to it to turn it into poetry?
Well,
right. Yeah.
And you have to be, I mean, and you have to, like, I have to be careful too, because I forget
right
which writer said this. I think it was, I'm blanking on his name now, the famous, like, I think it's a Polish poet, Cesar Milosz, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not saying that correctly, but he had said something around the lines of, like, the writer finishes the family, which sounds negative, right? But my friend Gretchen, who's a poet in Minneapolis, she said she preferred hearing that like a woodworker finishes a piece of wood.
Right.
That, like, in a way that the storyteller who is getting these stories handed down to him or her through interview or through just, like, for me growing up, I mean, like, I grew up in Minnesota, but I lived, you know, I'd come over for Christmas and for holidays to Beersford, and we would, and my family, they would stay up all night so that I'd hear them talking when I would be carried off to bed at night by like 1 o'clock. And then I'd wake up at 7 and they'd still be downstairs talking. I could hear their voices, like, through the floors of grandma's house. And it was like, those, I wasn't interviewing them per se at 8 or 10 years old, but you are, like, internalizing these stories that are being told. And so it's helpful if every family has not maybe one, but a couple of storytellers.
Oh yeah. Teach your, get your kids some poetry, you know, magnetic poetry, and then just,
right.
And then be really careful what you say.
Yes, right.
On the fire pit.
Right. There have been times when the families have, like, at particularly raucous weddings.
Sure.
That in central Nebraska, I won't go into more detail, but that, you know, that should be enough for listeners. But an aunt, let's say, as she was rushing out to tend to, like, a fist fight that had happened, she said, an aunt turned to me and she said, "Christopher, this, you can't write about this." Anyway.
Fair enough.
Okay.
I want to know this too, Chris. Does being a poet also help, does it serve as a protective force for you, a different way of expression when some things just don't fit? Is it part of your, you know, what you would today maybe call self-care? Like, how does poetry land on you as a reporter?
Yes, that is, I've no one's ever said that, but that probably is actually exactly how it works, is that oftentimes there are, and I want to preface by saying that, like, you know, I clearly am, like, I love my day job as a journalist, right? There's so many different ways to engage with the world that's so satisfying. However, there are times when something will happen during the day, even in the news, right? The quote-unquote news, what we deem to be news, that because of journalistic conventions and restraints, I feel like I'm not able to express what I want to say in that moment in through that form of writing a, you know, 16-inch article.
Yep.
And so I do think that there are ways it works. I think self-care is actually an excellent way of thinking about it. I know oftentimes I'll go back to my wife, Carrie, and be like, "Can you believe what happened today in Pierre?" and blah, blah, blah. And she'll be like, "I don't want to hear it anymore." And so maybe I do then take it to
get your notebook out.
Yeah. Yes,
the page totally wants to hear it, Chris. The page will always listen. Okay.
Page,
we're going to,
a good listener. Yes.
We're going to leave it there, but now I'm totally signing up for this presentation. I mean, I was going to anyway, but I'm sure somebody else listening is. October 3rd, noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain at the South Dakota Festival Books. We'll put all the links up for the virtual festival on our website. You've been listening to Christopher von Drawcheck. His book is called Rattlesnake Summer. Highly recommend. And everything will be on our show notes at sdpb.org/news. Chris, thank you.
Thanks so much, Laurie. Appreciate it.